continue now with the May 9th edition of Freedom Radio. I am your host, Tim Sumner, United States Army retired, and the co-founder of 9/11 Families for a Safe and Strong America. On Saturday, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his four senior al-Qaeda assistants were arraigned on murder and conspiracy charges in connection with the 9/11 attacks that resulted in the deaths of 2,976 men, women, and children. Charles Colley Simpson joins us now to talk about the trial. Mr. Simpson is a nationally recognized expert in national security, homeland security, and crime control. He currently serves as the chief of staff to the president and senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Before joining Heritage in 2007, Mr. Simpson served as deputy assistant secretary of defense for detainee affairs. He advised then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and coordinated the Pentagon's global detention policy and operations, including at Guantanamo and in Iraq and Afghanistan. In addition to his considerable experience as a trial lawyer, Mr. Simpson served three tours of active duty in the Navy's Judge Advocate General's Corps. He continues to serve with the rank of commander as executive officer of Reserve Trial Judiciary and as a military trial judge. He is frequently seen in television news interviews and quoted in major newspapers. We are honored that he joins us this morning. Khalid Simpson, welcome to Freedom Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Media reports describe what happened in court Saturday as chaotic. My friend Michelle Malcolm called it the Gitmo Circus. Are you surprised by anything you've seen so far?
No, not at all. In fact, I monitored the proceedings as well and called it coordinated chaos, which I think is an accurate description of what happened. Recall that he had been arraigned before, and this is several years ago, and had attempted to control the narrative in the courtroom, and he will do the same in this trial. But that's no different than other terrorists. For example, the Zacharias Moussaoui trial. He was tried here in federal district court in the Eastern District of Virginia here in Alexandria, and he tried to turn the courtroom into his playground and circus. And so this is what they do. And regardless of that fact, justice will march forward, and I'm very hopeful that justice will be served at the end of the day.
Yes, I certainly agree. Well, I witnessed it along with my wife at Fort Meade at the family viewing area there. We saw the prosecution team seem very professional. The judge was very patient. Some would might say more than patient for the 13-hour arraignment. It was a pretty incredible scene. I would say it was markedly different from one side of the courtroom to the other, including lawyers on the other side. How did that strike you, how the conduct of the defense team, if you would, the defense lawyers?
Look, you know, zealous advocacy on behalf of both sides is what a properly functioning judicial system requires. And so I've been a defense attorney in the military and outside of the military, and been, you know, prosecutor at the local, state, and federal level and in the military, and now I'm privileged to be a judge. And so I've seen it from all sides. And there's a strategy here, and the strategy here is to attempt to delegitimize military commissions. And that's the strategy they're going to continue to pursue, along with a substantive legal strategy, which is to attack the merits of the case, focus on the evidence. The fact of the matter is that federal judges, including military judges, have the power to control the order of events in front of them, in their courtroom. I do that. Judge Pohl does that. Any good military judge does that. The defense wanted to address issues unrelated to the arraignment. We don't like the clothing. We don't like this. We want to talk about torture. We want to talk about you name it. And the judge is like, look, we are here for an arraignment. All the rest of that is in due time. And so the defense thought it was in their client's best interest to try to bring up these things that were extraneous to the arraignment. Now, just so your viewers understand this, an arraignment in military court, including military commissions, should take about 30 minutes. That's it. The only thing you got to go over is the counsel selection, who the accused wants to represent them, whether they understand the nature of the proceedings against them, and whether they want the charges read against them. 999 out of 1,000 times the accused, the defendant, waives the reading of the charges. This time, as you know, one of the defendants wanted the charges read, I think just to be a pain in the patootie. I really think that's why he was doing it. He did not do it because he was unaware of what the charges were. He was just trying to make it more difficult on the government. But that's their choice. That's allowed for in the script. It happens every now and then. And I think that they're going to continue in this vein.
And that's a good point. I think I've seen some military court-martials over their careers. Typically, they are pretty much open and closed. It's just like a standard arraignment, what most folks view of someone being brought before a judge initially on charges. So, you know, typically those are very brief, and this was pretty well dragged out. We did see some courtroom antics, I guess. Courtroom jihad would be a good way to describe actions of the defendants in this case, including one moment where they got down to pray in the middle of the season, wouldn't answer the judge's questions.
Right.
That type of thing. You know, and you mentioned...
Yeah, now I will point this out, and I'm sure you know this. We accommodate the religious needs of the detainees. We're required to under the Geneva Conventions, and here this enemy makes it a practice within their religious beliefs to pray five times a day, and we accommodate those religious beliefs, including in court. And so that's not unusual. And just for example, you took this scenario and put it in a different context. If somebody had a religious affiliation such that their day of Sabbath was on a Friday, well, the court would obviously listen to that and perhaps not hold court on Friday. And so the judge is doing what he can to control the courtroom, but of course he's going to allow them to put any complaints on the record so that he has, if there's a conviction, a solid record on appeal and doesn't give them any room for an appeal.
This is a complicated case, and as many have pointed out, it's going to take a good while to actually conduct.
Yeah.
A lot of that will depend upon what these folks finally decide to do. We saw in 2008 Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his senior cohorts attempt to plead guilty,
mm-hmm.
and right now it's been deferred until the entering of plea until June 12th, which is the next hearing date. But as we go forward, you know, what are you kind of your predictions for how these folks will try to act in court and continue? Will they continue to disrupt? What's your belief?
Just a quick history lesson here. When KSM tried to plead guilty before, the military commission's rules were modeled virtually identical with court martial rules, and in standard courts martial, as you know, from your service, they don't allow you to plead guilty to a capital offense. Now, federal courts and state courts do, but in the military courts martial, we don't, and so therefore military commissions didn't. Well, Congress finally cleaned that up and clarified that a little bit ago, and now you can plead guilty to a capital offense. Now, I think it's an entirely open question as to whether or not Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or any of his co-conspirators will attempt to plead guilty on June 12th or any point thereafter. I think what you can be sure of is that the government is going to proceed as if there's going to be a contested trial and will methodically go through all the evidence, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of pieces of evidence, including emails, et cetera, and turning that over in discovery, if it's discoverable to the defense. There'll be dozens, if not hundreds, of pretrial motions filed by the defense and some by the government to narrow and shape the scope of the trial. And that's why I think when folks say that the trial is a long way off, they're right. It is a long way off. But I think anyone who says they know how this is going to turn out or they know what's going to happen really doesn't know what they're talking about, because these defendants are predictably unpredictable. They will do what they think is in their best interest to maximize the platform they have, and that's court. And so were there a contested trial, I think it's years off. How long the trial will take is no one really knows. It will probably take some number of months to get through the whole trial. And then, of course, there's three levels of appeals. There's the Military Commission's Court of Appeals. There's the D.C. Circuit, which is the second highest court in the land. And then there's, of course, an appeal to the United States Supreme Court if the court decides to take up the case. So I think we're a decade or more away for full closure if there's a trial and conviction and ultimately the appeals are exhausted. So I know people feel like we've been at this for a long time, but I hate to tell folks, but we're just getting started.
Yes, but they're not going anywhere anytime soon either.
They're not.
They can go on and do this for years, but fortunately, they're where they they're under detention in one way or the other. Speaking of courts, either whether it's a federal court or a military commission, both have the same rules. If you plead guilty in a military court or a federal court, they conduct the penalty phase where the courts have to present a full case. It's not like you can just plead guilty and then they go right to sentencing.
Yeah, 2 points. First off, military commissions are part of federal court, just like military courts martial are part of federal court. They're part and parcel of the broader fabric of federal trials. The opponents of military commissions, which are an extreme minority of people now, try to pretend just by repeating things over and over that they're not federal courts. But, of course, they are. They're passed by Congress, signed by the president, and the military judges are, of course, federal judges. The second point, which is, you know, to expand on your excellent point, is all death penalty trials, and I used to be a homicide prosecutor at the state court level, so I have some familiarity with this. So all death penalty trials are what are called bifurcated trials. Think of it as two trials in one. The first part of the trial is the finding section, whether the person's guilty or innocent. And if you found guilty, then there's a whole other contested trial where 12 jurors have to unanimously find that the aggravating, the bad stuff related to the offense, outweigh the mitigating factors that the defendant's going to put up. And if they find that, then they can recommend the death penalty, and the judge could affirm it in his final ruling. Here's a weird thought game. If KSM is convicted, or if he pleads guilty, he might ask for the death penalty, even against his attorney's advice. Wouldn't it be an odd situation where, typically in a death penalty case, the defendant is begging for his life, in other words, not to impose the death penalty? Here you might have a defendant asking for death to martyr himself. You have the government asking for death, which is the appropriate punishment, and obviously in this case. And you have a jury who's going to have to decide by themselves whether or not they agree with the accused and give him what he wants and certainly deserves if he's convicted, or decides not to martyr him and goes against both the government and the accused. That's the position they'll be in if he's convicted of capital eligible offenses and he goes to the penalty phase.
Yeah, beyond my personal connection to this case, my brother was killed as a 9/11 firefighter. Beyond that, I think we can all pretty much look at a mass murder of this scale and say, I'd say not all, but most would say that the appropriate sentence for this type of crime is death, mass murder. And people have said, well, then you're giving him what he wants. But does it really matter what he wants or what I want? Doesn't it matter what's appropriate for the crime?
It's going to matter what those 12 men and women on the jury ultimately decide if they get to that point. And, you know, there are death-eligible offenses that involve one person and one victim in state and federal courts. And so if you have a moral objection to the death penalty, that's one thing. That means you're actually not legally entitled to sit on the jury because you cannot sit on a jury if you're not a death-eligible juror. So assuming he's convicted, and we don't know whether he will be or not, and if they get to a penalty phase, you're going to have death-eligible jurors who will then ultimately decide amongst themselves whether they can reach unanimity and decide to impose the ultimate punishment, taking into consideration the aggravating and mitigating circumstances. That's just the way it is. I mean, on 9/11, even though I was in the reserves, I was working for Marsh McLennan. And as you know, the first plane hit the first tower hit Marsh.
Right.
They were in the 93rd through 100th floor, so I lost 295 of my colleagues, too. I didn't have the horrible misfortune of losing a loved one like you did. I'm sorry for your loss. That's terrible. But, you know, having practiced in military court for almost two decades now, military jurors, and you know this, are smart. They're well-educated. They follow the law. They follow the judge's instructions. They do their best. And so I think that at the end of the day, if the jury gets the case, they're going to do the very best they can.
We're going to continue to see, obviously, from, for lack of a good word, I guess, the leftist side of the political spectrum, arguments against detention, military commissions. These have been around for all our history as a nation as far as detaining the enemy. It's routine. And military tribunals have been used by President Washington, President Lincoln, President Roosevelt as an FDR. So it's not like these are not instituted, and this is a military trial.
Right. I mean,
speak to that for a moment about military trials. Even though it's not a military court-martial, you know, one of the allegations is that the folks involved have no experience. So we're talking about a senior team of law, military and Department of Justice officials. Talk a little bit about the prosecution side of this.
Yeah. Yeah, to your point, obviously, those who say that military detention of the enemy during wartime is illegitimate are just empirically wrong. They're talking about what they wish, not what is legal. When you're engaged in armed conflict, you are entitled to use not only non-lethal force to detain the enemy, which is the humane thing that the Geneva Conventions encompasses and wants you to do, but, of course, lethal force in appropriate circumstances. And so here's the bottom line with this crowd. They don't think we're at war. They think it's a big crime, and they want to default to the President Clinton way of dealing with things, which is try them or set them free, which is a pure criminal law concept, not a law of war concept. And so at the end of the day, that's what they believe, and you know they're just wrong. The prosecution team is headed by a friend of mine and a really brilliant, distinguished officer named Brigadier General Mark Martins. And although he hasn't spent the last 25 years in court, we don't do that in the JAG Corps. We serve in a variety of capacities. He's a law of war, law of armed conflict expert. He's set up the rule of law field force in Afghanistan, which not only implemented and rolled out initiatives establishing and helping reestablish the rule of law in Afghanistan, but also working with detention operations over there and the tribal court system. But he's served honorably advising General Petraeus and others. And career prosecutors, professional prosecutors such as myself, you know, they spend the majority of their career in court. But JAGs don't. But that doesn't mean that the time they have spent in court isn't very valuable. And this team is a hybrid team with Mark Martins at the head. You have some JAG reservists who were recalled to active duty who were career prosecutors. You have other active duty JAGs who don't have as much trial experience, arguably none, very little compared to their civilian counterparts, but understand the military justice system well. And so that's exactly the blend of people you need. You need people in and out of uniform with a variety of different experiences, not only the law of armed conflict, but working at the appeals side, understanding the military justice system, understanding the federal rules of evidence, understanding the Classified Information Procedures Act, which is going to play a big part. They have a great gal named Joanna Baldus, who is a DOJ prosecutor. She came from San Diego, where I used to be a prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office. So that's where she was. And so Mark has cobbled together, which was no easy task, I think a really good team. Could there be a better team? I don't know. Theoretically, I think that you know you can always say this person should not be there, or that person should be there. But I think given the circumstances, he's put together, I think, a top-notch team and one we can all be proud of. And by the way, the rules allow for and the defense has taken advantage of the top criminal defense attorneys. These are civilian criminal defense attorneys our country has ever produced. So if you look at David Nevin, who is representing Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, if you look at Rick Kamen, who's from Indianapolis, who's representing Al Nashri, the USS Cole Bomber. These guys are the lawyers you'd want to represent you if you got in deep trouble. I mean, they have tried the toughest, hardest, longest cases as criminal defense attorneys in the country. And so the defendants are very, very ably represented, and the government has put forward a good team, and that's what you want. You want a clash of the titans to test and push the system, whether it be, you know, federal district court or military commissions, and you have a good judge, a very experienced, solid judge, and so for those who criticize the commission system as a new system of rules, et cetera, by definition, every military commission is created for the purpose of holding people accountable during wartime. That's the way it is, and so I think that those few extremists who criticize commissions should withhold judgment. They won't, of course, and as they see the commission's process unfold?
It's going to be interesting, obviously. I think it's going to be, as you say, it's going to take some time. Are you confident at the end of the day that the system will work, the prosecution will, at least in terms of the system will work? Regardless of what any of us think at the end of the day, do you think the system will be seen as credible?
I do. There'll be some who simply reject the idea of commissions and always will. But I think this series of public speeches that Brigadier General Mark Martins has made explaining in minute detail the system and how it's created, the fact that two administrations now have blessed and used commissions, that bipartisan groups of Congress and senators have signed on to commissions, that the rules, if you go to www.heritage.org and type in detention of the enemy during wartime, you can see this chart that I created comparing the rules for military commissions against standard courts martial and then the international criminal tribunals of Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and you see the commission's rules are much fairer to the defendant. And so I think that those naysayers about commissions are just empirically wrong, but some people just are not going to change their mind because they only want federal court and they don't think we're at war.
Well, we so appreciate you having joined us here today. This is Charles Cully Stimson of the Heritage Foundation. You mentioned the website, heritage.org. Appreciate you coming and joining us today. We hope that you'll come back and talk about this trial as it proceeds down the road and give us your views on events as they happen.
Well, thank you. I'm sure I'll see you at some of these venues because I'm one of the NGOs now that gets to go to these trials as an observer, and I really am very grateful for the opportunity to spend some time with you.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back with Freedom Radio.